Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll see if Americans agree with claims made by President Barack Obama in his final State of the Union address. First, former Philadelphia Mayor John Street came out of the shadows this week to defend indicted Congressman Shaka Fatah. Details from WHYY's Katie Colinari.
Street made a rare public appearance at an event for retiring State Senator Shirley Kitchen, who wants to pass the baton to his son, Sharif Street. The standing room only crowd of elected officials and community activists from North Philly seemed glad to see the former mayor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Officially, Street was there to introduce Kitchen, but he also urged the audience to stand by Congressman Shaka Fatah, who sat right behind him as he spoke.
Be disgraceful if a person gives us all that service and we turn our back on him when he's under attack. It will be disgraceful.
Fatah is facing corruption charges. Among other things, prosecutors say the congressman used $600,000 in federal and charitable funds to pay back an illegal campaign loan. Fatah insists he's innocent, but after winning re-election easily for 20 years, his legal problems have attracted challengers. Four other Democrats, including State Representative Dwight Evans, are running against him in the April primary. Street had harsh words for those who would take advantage of Fatah's situation.
Who do people think they are? They're going to just like turn and take him out just like that? I don't think so.
Later, Street insisted he wasn't calling out any of Fatah's challengers in particular. They have a right to run. He says voters just needed a reminder Fatah is innocent until proven guilty. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
A boiler explosion at a Northwest Philadelphia elementary school this week left a maintenance worker in critical condition with third-degree burns. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, the Service Employee Union has compelled the district to put safety inspections on a more aggressive timetable.
On Wednesday, when a veteran maintenance worker attempted to ignite the backup boiler at Edmonds Elementary, it exploded, causing the building to shake and engulfing the man in flames. The building engineer rushed to the boiler room, put the fire out, and dragged the man to safety. All students and staff were also evacuated without harm. The service union, SEIU 32BJ, says the incident speaks to systemic issues of unsafe conditions in schools due to deteriorating infrastructure. Surrounded by dozens of union members, Regional Vice President Gabe Morgan called for transparency at a news conference outside district headquarters.
We're here today because we're demanding that they tell us what is going to change. Once people are being lit on fire at work in the school district, something has to change.
District officials stressed that the cause of the explosion is still unknown. All boilers are inspected every 2 years by the Hartford Insurance Company. The boiler in question is nearing the end of a 30-year life cycle and was reviewed last year. Spokesman Fernando Gallard says the district's aging infrastructure needs an estimated $4 billion in top-to-bottom repairs. Still, he says, building conditions do not place students and employees at risk.
We believe our buildings are safe. We'll do whatever it needs to be done to make sure that it continues to be safe for staff, for students, for all employees.
After their news conference, union leaders met with high-level district officials. The district agreed to reinspect all boilers and get union input on an overall plan to improve facilities citywide. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
Turning to this evening's headlines, Vice President Joe Biden joined area cancer leaders at Philadelphia's Abramson Cancer Center this afternoon to roll out a new project with a rather ambitious goal. And still ahead with on NewsWorks Tonight, I'll be speaking with WHYY's Alana Gordon to make sense of that announcement. An appeals court says Atlantic City's Trump Taj Mahal Casino was within its rights to end health insurance and pension benefits to its workers. And that removes the last major obstacle to billionaire Carl Icahn taking it over. The court ruled today in favor of the casino's parent company, Trump Entertainment Resorts, which ended benefits in October 2014 as part of its bankruptcy filing. The company said it could no longer afford the benefits, and it gave workers stipends to find insurance on the open market, including under the Federal Affordable Care Act. Icahn is acquiring the casino and has been keeping it afloat financially for more than a year. Also in New Jersey, lawyers for Governor Chris Christie and state health officials have asked a judge to throw out a lawsuit from a nurse who was quarantined in the state because she had contact with Ebola patients in West Africa in 2014. State lawyers stated today in response to nurse Casey Hickok's federal civil rights lawsuit that health workers acted with the public safety in mind when they had her quarantined. Hickox was working with Doctors Without Borders in Sierra Leone during the deadly Ebola outbreak. She was stopped when she arrived at Newark Liberty International Airport and questioned before being quarantined. She tested negative for Ebola. The state also says that Christie and other officials are immune from lawsuits over public health quarantines. 45 degrees, partly cloudy skies at 6:11. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. The evening forecast, overcast, and then showers overnight, perhaps into tomorrow morning. Tonight's low 38 degrees. Turning partly sunny, winds picking up tomorrow, Saturday's high 48. Sunday, enjoy intervals of sun and clouds, cooler, high 38 degrees. For Martin Luther King Jr. Day, sunny, brisk, Monday's high 28. Tuesday, plenty of sunshine, high 30 degrees. You're listening to WHYY-FM. Still ahead, Temple University is set to hire a new librarian, and it goes by the name BookBot.
There are two very large windows where you can see its operations, which gets people very excited. The robot itself is painted a kind of very flashy yellow color, so it has a kind of personality that people are attracted to.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
What if I told you that Big Bird was moving to HBO?
The market for children's television right now is changing in quite dramatic fashion.
I'm Molly Wood, the business of children's television. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m. 11, 12.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Annenberg Center Live supports WHYY and presents Ballet Hispanico, a contemporary dance ensemble mixing an eclectic modern style with the energy and flair of Latino cultures. Theatricality and passion propel every move when Ballet Hispanico takes the stage on February 5th and 6th at Annenberg Center Live. For tickets to Ballet Hispanico on February 5th and 6th at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Well, now about 2.5 weeks out from the Iowa caucuses, let's look ahead in the context of where we've come, as laid out by President Barack Obama in his final State of the Union address this week. Joining me in conversation is Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Hey, Frank, what do you say we take up some of the president's talking points in the context of how they resonate with public opinion? The president said anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction.
We've asked before, what's the number one power economically in the world? Americans say China. We've also said, is the United States the number one economic power in the world, or just one of many leading economic powers? And the majority, significant majority, say just one of many leading economic powers. And also, the president said the economy is not in decline, it's getting better. When we ask Americans, is the economy getting better or getting worse right now, we have a majority who say getting worse, not better. It's only about 30% who say it's getting better. So when you put all that together, I would say the public probably is not in tune with President Obama when he said those things about how great the economy is.
Let's go overseas, foreign policy, where the president said Tuesday night that the United States is the most powerful nation on earth, period. It's not even close.
The American public would agree if he's talking about the military. The public likes the military. That's number one on our confidence and institutions list. So there you get a yes from the American public.
What does the American public then think about the House of Representatives, who were certainly in attendance at the president's address?
Well, it's an interesting question. His approval, Obama's approval, as he stood before them with Biden and Ryan behind him, was about 45-46%. The men and women who spread out in front of him, members of Congress, approval as a body, 16%. So that's like a 3-to-1 ratio. Although we always have to say when you ask people about their individual person in Congress, of course, it's a lot higher. But as a body, terrible ratings for Congress.
Though I understand increasingly voters don't affiliate with a specific party.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point that we've talked about this in religious context, Dave. 20% of Americans now, when you say, what religion are you? You say, none. They're not Baptist. They're not Catholic. They're not Jewish. They don't have a religious affiliation. We're seeing the same thing when it comes to party ID now. We have about 42% of Americans who say they're independent when we ask them, are you Republican or Democrat or independent? In fact, the 29% who say they're Democrats is the lowest identification with the Democratic Party in our Gallup history.
Though the religious nuns, I presume by definition, have unplugged from organized religion, are the independent voters unplugged from the political process?
Well, that's an interesting question. They don't like to identify with the party, but obviously in most elections, you have to vote for one or the other. And when we probe these independents, the 42%, and say, all right, do you lean one way or the other? All but about 12% will say, yeah, I'll lean one way or the other. And typically they would vote for one party or the other. But what we're finding is, we just don't have this top of mind, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, certainly that we have found in past years and past decades.
Back to the president, who also made a point of saying, if anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it.
A majority of Americans now will say that the effects of climate change are being felt. But actually, it's in the low 50% range now. And at one point, about a decade ago, it was up at 60%. So that's been going down, not up. The two big things about climate change from the public's perspective are, one, they are not worried about it. Only a third say they worry a lot about it. When we say, what environmental problems bother you? Pollution of drinking water much higher than global warming. When we say, what's the most important problem facing the country? Almost no Americans mention global warming or climate change, which is interesting. And also, the second thing I would say is it's become partisan. The fascinating change is that Republicans now view this like they view Obamacare. So when you say climate change, Republicans seem to say, yeah, that's that liberal effort to try to put more controls on the oil and gas industry and so forth. So it's got a lot of political overtones nowadays.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Vice President Joe Biden came to Philadelphia this afternoon to declare that the world of cancer research is on the cusp of phenomenal breakthroughs. Joining me live from Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania with details is WHYY's Alana Gordon. Good evening, Alana.
Hi, Dave.
What's the nature of these breakthroughs?
So the nature of these breakthroughs comes on the cusp of President Obama earlier this week launching a new initiative and putting Vice President Biden in kind of mission control of this moonshot initiative, where we have a lot of advancements that he's talked about, whether that's immunotherapy, whether that's genomics, whether that's finding ways to prevent cancer. And so with all of these things happening right now, he talked a lot about how we're at an inflection point and he wants to really accelerate that.
JFK's original moonshot challenge was at the start of the decade to put a man on the moon by the end of the 60s. That was accomplished. Let's listen to Joe Biden discuss the timetable for this venture.
And the goal is, whatever breakthroughs we can make in 10 years, my goal is to make sure we can do it in 5 years. Mm-hmm. My goal is that we find absolute cures, but for some cancers, we get to the point where we can manage them, they become chronic diseases.
Alana, who are the we that the vice president are talking about in this collaborative venture?
He's talking about a lot of people. He's talking about really breaking down barriers, actually, in terms of going across different academic disciplines, private industry, as well as the public. But he came to the Perelman School of Medicine today to talk with a lot of the cancer researchers there and academic leaders, as well as oncologists, to kind of point to and ask them. He's been gathering a lot of information from around the country to ask, what do we need to do to really accelerate this? What are some of the things that can happen? Some of the things he pointed to here at Penn was a lot of the work of people like Dr. Carl June and some immunotherapies. And in fact, up front at this event in this roundtable was sitting watching was a young woman, Emily Whitehead, who's the first pediatric patient to undergo some really new types of immunotherapies. And the idea is that 20, 30 years ago, this wasn't even thought about. It wasn't on the horizon. So he's looking to some of these things around what some of the researchers are doing to how to advance that and how to connect that with some of the research that other places are doing and how to accelerate those sorts of things.
And I understand part of the challenge is amassing all this information and then sharing the data.
Absolutely. One of the biggest things that he talked about in terms of how to make this move forward is there's a lot of data out there. And he posed a big question to people about, what about big data? How can we share all this information? There's lots of research happening. There's lots of patients. There's lots of things going on in these different silos. So one of the big questions he has moving forward is asking of these researchers, asking of the community, what can we do with all of this data and information to better understand how to target things? Because one of the big things, the big pushbacks is, you know, this idea of a cure for cancer, it's something that's been around for a while. It dates back to President Nixon declaring a war on cancer. And since then, scientists have realized that cancer is not one thing. It's many diseases. There are many moonshots. There are many targets. So this is about getting everybody, I guess you could say, on the same flight.
And though it is still being led by the White House, here's the Vice President once again.
This is not an NIH program per se. This is not a federal initiative per se. This is using all the assets and capacities of the federal government. There is an executive order the President is going to be announcing shortly that is going to put me in charge of, and it tasks every major agency.
Alana, again, review with us why this launch was announced right here in Philadelphia.
I think it's part of a broader push, but one of the reasons is Biden, you know, he has a connection with Philadelphia and with Pennsylvania, but immunotherapy is one of the things in the research that's happening here that has really been on his radar. And one of the goals, even in that conversation at the roundtable and asking about some of the research happening here, is have you talked to the other researchers at the other academic centers? And how can we all do a better job of coordinating these things to pool our information, to pool our data, to better understand whether that's in a place like Philadelphia or beyond? And one of the things punted back to Biden from some of these researchers was, well, you can be this kind of important piece of this puzzle and help piece everything together to kind of be that kind of overarching link to something like this.
WHYY's Alana Gordon reporting. Also in the business of assembling data, Temple University is building a new library for the needs of the 21st century. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that any design for the library of the future has to ask, just what is a library anyway?
Temple University's main library, called Paley Library, was built 50 years ago. It's really big, about 215,000 square feet. The dean of libraries, Joseph Lucia, says most of it is used for storing more than 2 million books.
It's a big square warehouse with user space at the margins, literally around the exterior of the building on the upper floors, with a big sort of open space on the first floor. You know, in 2016, we don't think of libraries in quite the same way.
There's a new library being built across the street. It's got the same square footage as the old library, same number of books, but instead of 60% of the space reserved for books and 40% for users, the new library will be flipped. Books and documents will take only about 40% of the space, and the lion's share of the real estate will be classrooms, meeting rooms, maker spaces, and digital visualization studios. So how can you cram 2 million books into a tenth of the space? You use a book box. The books are packed inside metal bins, which are then stacked in a matrix, 55 feet high, 150 feet long. When a user wants a particular book, Lucia says they will search a database connected to a robotic crane.
They will click a button that says, get me this item, and that will dispatch a command to the software that interacts with the robots. They will activate the appropriate crane to go to the bin where that item is located, pull that bin, bring it to a pickup point where a staff member would open the bin, find the book, and then put it on a pickup shelf.
The whole process takes about a minute. The new library will have 5 of these bays, each with its own automated retrieval crane. The system is based on warehouse technology used by giant retail shipping companies like Amazon. It is not organized by the Dewey Decimal System. It doesn't even use the alphabet. When a book is returned to the stacks, the robot puts it wherever is most convenient for the robot.
It goes back to the first available space. Probably, if the algorithm works as I understand it, might be in closest proximity to where the crane is that's going to put it back.
The sound you're hearing is from a YouTube video of a similar robot in operation at the James Hunt Library at the University of North Carolina. The robot does not make room for people in its stacks, but a lot of people like to watch BookBot. The same guy designed libraries in North Carolina and Philadelphia. His name is Craig Dykers of the firm Snoheda.
You could potentially just bury the technology in the building. No one could see it. But we exposed it. There are two very large windows where you can see its operations, which gets people very excited. The robot itself is painted a kind of very flashy yellow color. So it has a kind of personality that people are attracted to.
The BookBot has got flash, and there are about 40 of these systems online in the United States. But its ultimate importance to the library of the future is uncertain. Printed books are quickly giving away to digital information. So after studying the data, talking to consultants, and asking his crystal ball about the library of the future, Joe Lucia still says it's a $6 million gamble.
That's the real challenge, and this is where we're making what might be considered some expensive guesses, but some guesses about what the relevance of that material is. And this large automated search and retrieval system could, in the end, be repurposable space, that it would, if you needed at some point to remove that expensive equipment and remove that collection, you could, in fact, use that space in other ways.
This is an academic library, which Lucia says is used differently than a public library. Students tend to rely more on printed material than the public. So the new library at Temple will keep 200,000 books out of the robotic system on traditional shelves that can be browsed by hand. When designing a library, Dykers takes into consideration the symbolic heft of standing among collected knowledge 2 million strong.
All great libraries should inspire people. A great building that is a part of the development of culture should manage all the senses and inspire us in some way.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Brett Rader and our intern, Jared Whalen. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.